Today is Tuesday, September 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, Myanmar convicts two Reuters journalists who uncovered Rohingya atrocities.
We would call on the journalists to be released as soon as possible, immediately.
A UN watchdog calls the bombing of a school bus in Yemen a possible war crime. A mainly white South African worker union strikes over discrimination. And confusion over the Aretha Franklin estate as the late Queen of Soul didn't leave a will. It's all on today's International Edition. Two Reuters news journalists have been convicted in Myanmar of violating the country's secrecy laws and sentenced to 7 years in prison. They were covering the military crackdown in Rakhine State that has driven nearly 700,000 Rohingya Muslims across the border into Bangladesh since August of last year. Diplomats, media rights activists, and the UN's new human rights chief denounced the sentences. British diplomat Dan Chugg says proper legal procedures were not followed by the country's judiciary.
Many diplomats have been at the trial throughout, and we believe that the judge has ignored the evidence of the case.
Chugg also says the harsh verdict is bad news for freedom of speech in Myanmar.
We think that in a democracy, journalists should be allowed to practice their jobs without intimidation and without fear. And this case has very much undermined freedom of the media in Myanmar. The verdict and the judgment today has also struck a hammer blow to the rule of law.
Daniel Bastard heads the Asia-Pacific desk at Reporters Without Borders in Paris. He explained to International Edition's Sarah Williams his organization's response to the sentencing.
Well, we are totally appalled by this very outrageous verdict. The two Reuters journalists got 7 years in jail for what? For trying to do their job, which is to investigate what the UN has called a genocide. So we are really worried about the future of press freedom in Myanmar, in Burma.
And apparently there was, I believe, during the trial, there was some evidence that a police officer, basically he said that his superiors framed the journalists by giving them supposedly classifying documents and then immediately arresting them.
Exactly. The entire prosecution case is like a farce. As you said, they were handed some so-called documents and arrested right after. They didn't have time to see what was inside these documents. So this is clearly an example of fabricated evidence. And with this fabricated evidence and very troubleful arrest, the verdict of this morning, there has been many procedural violations, changing testimonies, and, well, the whole judiciary process is a farce.
Will an appeal take place?
Yes, their lawyer has already announced that they will appeal this decision, and we call on the Myanmar authorities to do whatever they can, and they can, obviously, to release the two reporters immediately and conditionally.
This certainly, though, this conviction and sentencing must concern other journalists. Also, the fact that these two men have been convicted of violating the Official Secrets Act, which was enacted back in 1923 when Myanmar was then known as Burma, and it was under British colonial rule. It is now an independent country.
Yeah, clearly what is behind this decision is a move by the authorities to intimidate other journalists and to lead them to self-censorship. And I've talked with journalists in Myanmar this morning, and most of them would tell me that they fear for their own fate. Like the authorities clearly said to other journalists, well, if you want to investigate on the Rohingya genocide or on other massacres, this is what your fate will be, 7 years in jail.
Daniel Bastard heads the Asia-Pacific desk at Reporters Without Borders. Human Rights Watch is calling for an immediate end to all arms sales to Saudi Arabia in the aftermath of the bombing of a school bus last month that killed 51 people including 40 children. In a report released Sunday, the HRW called the attack an apparent war crime, saying it only added to the Saudi-led coalition's already gruesome track record of killing civilians at weddings, funerals, hospitals, and schools in Yemen. The coalition, which has the support of the United States, has been fighting the Houthi rebels since March of 2015 and backs Yemen's internationally recognized government, which aims to restore it to power. Raihan Ismail is a lecturer at the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. She joins us now to discuss. What is your reaction to this being called a possible war crime?
I think the United Nations, I think you're absolutely right, the international community has condemned the atrocities committed in Yemen, and especially after the damning UN report, which states that, if I'm not mistaken, all sides in Yemen have violated international law that may amount to war crimes. So obviously, the international community is very concerned, and especially after the Saudi airstrike on a school bus in northern Yemen. And if you look at the Saudi led coalition has accepted responsibility for that airstrike, and it is quite uncharacteristic for the Saudi Emirati led coalition to take responsibility. They have been unapologetic before, and I think this is a turning point of the civil war in Yemen, because the Saudi led coalition has come under, you know, mounting pressure to limit civilian casualties.
Why are the Saudis and with the US in that coalition? They've been fighting the Houthi rebels since March of 2015. What are they trying to accomplish?
The Houthi rebels, they were mainly based in the north of Yemen. However, they've decided to capture the capital of Yemen, which is Sana'a. And I think that angered the Saudis, but made the Saudis and the coalition very concerned about Iranian involvement in Yemen. The Saudi-led coalition and the Emiratis are very much involved in the whole process as well, accused the Houthis of fighting on behalf of Yemen and accused the Iranians, not on behalf of the Iranians, and accused the Iranians of interfering in Arab affairs. And I think this is partly to do with Saudi Arabia's rivalry with Iran. So obviously they're very concerned about the Houthis. They've been fighting the Houthis since 2004. And in 2009, the Saudis were involved in attacking the Houthis in Yemen. However, after 2015, they were more concerned, nervous about the Iranian position in Yemen. They fear for what could happen to Saudi Arabia, especially when considering that Saudi Arabia shares borders with Yemen. So there are a number of factors, obviously, that's making the Saudis quite nervous about Houthi success or Houthi victory in Yemen.
And where does the U.S. fit into this? Because we have heard that these were U.S. bombs.
Absolutely. And I think it all depends on U.S.-Saudi relations. And I think U.S.-Saudi relations have improved dramatically following the, you know, election of President Trump. And if you look at the, you know, the U.S., they strongly back Saudi Arabia's operation in Yemen. This has been the case since 2015. And when President Trump came to power, I think President Trump strongly supported Saudi Arabia's led coalition in Yemen. And it's known that the Saudis buy weapons from the Americans. They have laser-guided bombs that were used in the attacks, and they were all weapons purchased from the United States. So obviously, many are quite critical of the United States' involvement in Yemen, obviously, you know, basically saying that they are partly responsible for the attacks in Yemen.
Are you aware of any statements by the U.S.?
The U.S.? In many ways are quite careful when commenting on Yemen. They're not critical of Saudi Arabia, but they've asked the Saudis to investigate the airstrikes, and especially the ones, the airstrike on a school bus in northern Yemen. So they've urged the Saudis to investigate. They've urged all parties to adhere to international law, but they have not really come out strongly against the Saudi-led coalition. In fact, they've maintained their support for the coalition. I think also the fact is the Saudis, they are losing the PR war in Yemen. With horrific images emerging from Yemen, the Saudi/Emirati-led coalition has lost a lot of credibility. Although other countries are committed to the coalition, Malaysia, for example, which used to be part of the coalition, has decided to withdraw its troops from Saudi Arabia, where they have been on standby. So I think the recent attack is a turning point of the civil war, as I've mentioned earlier. And I think the Saudis are also becoming more careful. I keep saying the Saudis, but the Emiratis and the Saudis are both heavily involved in the war in Yemen. I think they're more careful. They've decided to accept responsibility. They've apologized unreservedly to the victims of airstrike, which took place last month. So I think in many ways they are aware that the tide has turned against them, at least in the context of trying to appeal to the international community. Because until recently, they've demonized the Houthi rebels regionally, and they had a lot of regional support as well from different countries, Egypt, Bahrain, Sudan. They're all very supportive of the Saudi-led coalition. But now people are becoming more critical of the Saudis and also the Emiratis. So I think there's hope that this would push the Saudis and the Emiratis and all parties involved in the conflict to reach a ceasefire, or at least would lead to peace negotiations, hopefully.
All right, Raihan Ismail, a lecturer at the Center for Arab and Islamic Studies at the Australian National University. Thanks for being with us. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. U.S. service members been killed and other wounded in Afghanistan. Schools fail to open in Cameroon's restive English-speaking regions. Tropical Storm Gordon threatens South Florida. Time may be running out for millions of clocks. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. The U.S. Defense Department, acting on a decision made in January, announced it's canceling $300 million in coalition-supporting funds to Pakistan over its lack of decisive actions in support of U.S. South Asia policy, now a year old. At the time, President Trump denounced what he called Pakistan's harboring of terrorists like the Taliban. Another $550 million in assistance to Islamabad was cut by Congress earlier this year. The decision came ahead of a visit to the Pakistani capital by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and the chair of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Joseph Dunford, who planned to meet with new Prime Minister Imran Khan. Christine Fair is an associate professor in security studies at Georgetown University. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty the decision is long overdue, although he questions whether it is enough to change Pakistan's policy.
The step is certainly a step in the right direction. I don't personally think it's enough. Pakistan has a sense of entitlement to American money. Simply ceasing the monies that we've been giving them, it's not going to be enough to shape their behavior. But at least there is some satisfaction that we're not continuing to pay all of Pakistan's bills. I think the real issue to watch, however, isn't this bilateral funding. It's important. Obviously, it's a large sum of money. It is an important political signal. But I think the real issue is going to be the IMF, right? Pakistan has a regular pattern, that is to say that it lives well beyond its means, particularly the army. Every 6 or 7 years or so, it has to go into another IMF package. It makes a series of commitments that it's going to engage in financial reforms. And usually at around the penultimate payout, Pakistan tells the IMF, don't bother writing us another check. We have no intentions of honoring our commitments. It then withdraws from that relationship, and then only to go back to the IMF some years later, and the IMF, under U.S. pressure, fearing that Pakistan is too dangerous to fail, writes another bailout package without making Pakistan adhere to the commitments that it had previously made. And the stakes now are quite a bit higher. You may recall that Pompeo said that IMF monies would not be used to subsidize Chinese loans. But the problem with that, although I agree with the intention, money is fungible. So it's not clear to me how one can actually prevent Pakistan from using these monies to service its ever-accumulating Chinese debt.
Well, you probably know Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will be this week in Pakistan meeting the new prime minister.
The problem is this idea that Imran Khan can do anything, right? Imran Khan, though he is the prime minister, doesn't really control any of the levers of policy that are going to affect the kinds of outcomes that matter. And the outcomes that matter are really pertaining to Pakistan's longstanding relationship with the Taliban, every possible amenity that could be provided, Pakistan provides. Whether it's funding, whether it's military training, Pakistan even sends military troops to fight alongside the Afghan Taliban, ranging from low-end troops from Pakistan's Frontier Corps all the way up to Pakistan's elite SSG, which are basically their commandos. And this, of course, is in addition to diplomatic and political cover, as well as sanctuary in Pakistan's territory. These amenities that Pakistan has furnished to the Taliban, despite ostensibly being a U.S. partner, have driven the outcome of the war in Afghanistan.
All right, that's Christine Fair, Associate Professor in Security Studies at Georgetown University. In South Africa, a mainly white trade union is going on strike in protest over a profit-sharing plan that they say discriminates against them by only being available to black workers. It seems to be an unusual reversal of what we normally hear about in that country. Joining us now to discuss is Julian Ford, Professor of Law at Australia National University. First, tell us what this is all about.
This is a major South African company that's actually world famous for its production of fuel oils using coal. It was set up during the sanctions period on South Africa in order to avoid the oil embargo, and it came up with innovative technologies to derive fuel oil from coal. The dispute is around a scheme to offer black workers in that company, who are the majority of the workers in that company, to offer them a share scheme, to offer them some kind of an ownership in the company through the offer of small amounts of shares alongside their salary. But that offer is only available to black workers and not to white workers in that company. And so the strike is actually on the part of a union or collective of white South African workers in Sasol in the company who are excluded from the share scheme.
I would imagine this is pretty unusual.
It's very unusual. If you kind of take this in a historical arc, the whole history of modern history of South Africa has been about racial discrimination the other way. That was the controversy about South Africa. That was why South Africa was, you know, considered a pariah state for its systematic legalization of racial discrimination. And this is really a counterintuitive story on one level, because here it is white workers who are now in a minority, and white people are a minority in South Africa, who are striking on the basis of racial discrimination. But there is a longer genesis to this. This is not just an isolated story relating to one company in South Africa. What's happened since 1994, when Nelson Mandela became president, the end of the race-based legal system that underpinned minority white government in South Africa,
mm-hmm.
is that you had majority rule, you had democracy, and the end of racial discrimination. But in order to address some of the systematic legal discriminations of the past, which had disadvantaged the black majority, the new government, the Mandela government and successive ANC governments after that, implemented a quite long-term but quite sort of systematic affirmative action scheme, basically, which introduced a number of measures, some of them backed by legislation, the most important being the Black Economic Empowerment Act, or BEE. And the point of BEE was to increase the ownership of parts of the economy by black people, by African people. And it required companies in their hiring quotas and so on to meet certain requirements and to report on those requirements every year. And there were a whole range of very intricate regulations around black economic empowerment compliance. So that's been the sort of longer-term path since 1994 that the economy has been on. And I suppose what underlies this dispute is the sense that from these white workers that 20 years or more after this transformation, after the racial discrimination that underlay the apartheid state came to an end, the sense that, well, we're 20 years into this transformation, now if you're offering an employee share scheme, it should really be open to all South Africans, and the idea that you still need to make particular accommodation for black workers is unreasonable.
Are they overcompensating now?
There's still a long way to go in transforming ownership patterns in the South African economy. So one of the criticisms of the Black Economic Empowerment Scheme has been that it has created a sort of superclass of black business owners who have been able to use these quotas and so on to enter into the economy in those ways, but that it hasn't necessarily created at the bottom of the kind of workplace pyramid, so to speak, it hasn't necessarily created a broad class of African workers who have an ownership stake in the economy or a real stake in the economy other than their wage. So I think there's widespread understanding in South African society across all racial groups that there needed to be some kind of affirmative action scheme and transformational scheme, and that the state should have a role in enforcing that. I don't think there's any real disagreement about that across South African society, but the disagreement comes about how fast do you do that and on what scale do you do that, and also eventually how long do you keep doing that for? Do you keep doing it for 20 years or 30 years or 50 years before it starts to lose its tone as affirmative action and begin to become something else? And I suppose this group of workers are saying, well, we're 20 years into the post-apartheid transformation. If you're going to offer an employee share scheme at this point, it should just not have a racial dimension to it at all.
All right, that's Julian Ford, professor of law at Australia National University. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.
Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24/7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues. Well, the film industry organization that presents the Academy Awards is also developing young talent through a program called Academy Gold, an internship and mentoring program for students and young professionals from communities currently underrepresented in Hollywood. Some of the participants are either immigrants or children of immigrants who are trying to create an unorthodox career path for themselves. VOA's Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
Push this down here, that will release the pan.
While many come to Hollywood looking for fame in front of the camera, these interns prefer to work behind the lens.
I'm young, but I think I would really want to be a cinematographer in the future.
Iris Lee, a film student who just graduated from college, grew up watching and loving movies. She was born in the United States, but her parents are from Taiwan. And convincing them of what she wants to do has taken some time.
When they came here and had me, I don't think they expected me to have a career in entertainment. I don't think any first-generation children really go into entertainment.
You look pretty good.
The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences is trying to change this by creating more opportunities for immigrant children and other young underrepresented talent through its Academy Gold program.
African American, Latino, Asian American, women. We have a challenge in this industry of having women represented in some of our main labor categories.
Yemeni American Yusuf Asabahi wants to change perspectives that he sees on TV and films.
There are a lot of TV shows where Yemen comes up in the TV show, but it's considered as the hub of these fanatics and radicals that will just, they have no goal in life but to attack the West. And that's untrue.
Born in Yemen, Asabahi grew up traveling between the United States and his birthplace. When he told his parents about his dream of being a writer and director,
they were a little bit like, you know, it's a risky career, we know, but, you know, if that's what you love and I didn't face any resistance.
I don't know if you guys want to get hands-on.
As Academy Gold interns, Asabahi and others get hands-on experience on topics ranging from filmmaking to finances. The program includes a summer internship, chances to network, and the opportunity to be paired with a mentor throughout the year.
About 50% of the interns from last year's program were able to either get full-time jobs or other internships as a result of being in the Academy Gold program.
Ultimately, the work we're doing here is building equity. These young men and women are going to come up this industry together. They're going to build on each other's work. They're going to be hiring each other over the next couple of years.
Organizers say the goal is to help these interns succeed and create a pipeline for underrepresented talent so there can be more diversity in Hollywood. Elizabeth Lee, VOA News, Los Angeles.
Well, Aretha Franklin was so hard-nosed in her business dealings that she demanded to be paid in cash before performing, so it may come as a surprise that the singer died without a will. The AP's Julie Walker reports.
As Aretha Franklin's family members move on from Friday's funeral, where Ariana Grande sang one of the Queen of Soul's famous songs, they're left with the potentially tall task of finding out how many millions she was worth and divvying it up. Since Franklin did not leave a will under Michigan law, her four sons will inherit equal shares of their mother's wealth, but it could take years to even determine how much that is. Franklin wrote a few of her most classic songs, including Think, and earned money from them, but got next to nothing for many of her biggest hits, including Respect. I'm Julie Walker.
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, John Ellison. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During his travels in South America, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis called the ongoing tragedy in Venezuela a human-imposed condition. This is not some act of God, he noted. It's not something that just had to happen because it was a natural disaster. In fact, they sit on enormous oil reserves. They've got tremendous opportunity for their people. The United States abhors what the misguided Maduro regime has done to the once prosperous country. We stand with the people of Venezuela in the midst of the tragedy that's forced on them by the power-hungry, oppressive regime that has compelled the citizens to flee their own country, declared Secretary Mattis. President Nicolas Maduro has lashed out against and threatened neighbors who have pointed out the regime's failures. Maduro, said Secretary Mattis, should know that we do not solve our problems in this hemisphere in that way, and that we democracies will stand together in rejecting such bellicose language and the saber-rattling that is behind it. Simon Bolivar, a Venezuelan military and political leader who liberated Venezuela, Bolivia, Colombia, among others, from the Spanish rule, once said that the most perfect system of government is that which produces the highest sum of societal security and the highest sum of political stability. It was Maduro and his inner circle, said Secretary Mattis, that violated the liberator's proud legacy. Democracy, the rule of law, individual freedom, and human rights cannot be taken for granted, warned Secretary Mattis. It is important to remember this when looking at what Maduro has done to destroy Venezuela's democratic government. A key characteristic of a professional military is democratic civilian control. You see this in Brazil, Argentina, Chile, and Colombia, observed Secretary Mattis. But you will not see it in Cuba. You will not see it in Venezuela. You will not see it in Nicaragua, where the military is used to oppress their own people and keep certain regimes in power, noted Secretary Mattis. As a bulwark against these repressive regimes, the United States is seeking to broaden and deepen cooperation with allies and partners committed to strengthening democracy and the rule of law in the Western Hemisphere.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.